Hey everyone, this is Kathleen Kinmont from Halloween 4, and you gotta download the new episode of the Rants from the Black Lodge podcast, because they're doing an episode for Bride of Reanimator, which I am also in. This episode is killer, so download now.
Recording live from the Black Lodge, it's me, the free will burning, head turning, ass kicking, machismo dripping, master podcasting mouthpiece of the Southeast. Brandon A. Lane bringing you a new edition of the Rants from the Black Lodge podcast, and hot damn, we've got a banger of an episode tonight. Kicking off the festivities, we had that incredible introduction you heard at the top of the episode from the former Mrs. Lorenzo Lamas and Halloween 4 luminary, the lovely and incredibly talented Kathleen Kinmont. But in the context of this episode, I think you may better remember her as the bride, as in the Bride of Reanimator. That being said, if you can still not deduce all the obvious clues I'm hurling your way, tonight we have an incredible double feature lined up dissecting all things of the film at hand, Bride of Reanimator. But first on the docket, I was lucky enough to sit down this past week with the legendary director and producer, Brian Usna, where we discuss his 40 plus year career in film. But if that isn't enough to get you to click the download button for this episode, later on tonight we'll also bring you a full Bride of Reanimator retrospective. But first, here's some messages from our sponsors.
Hey assholes, it's me, Boner the Skeleton, mascot of the Rants from the Black Lodge podcast. Here to sell you some shit you probably can't afford. Are you low on cash? That's not a problem. Sell your children. Sell your blood. Go to the jack-off clinic and give them a sperm sample. We don't care how you get the money, as long as you give it to us. Want a t-shirt? Want a sticker or a mug to show that you're a true friend and a member of the Rant Army? Well, guess what? Go to Rant Army Surplus. The link is in the description. And if you don't buy something, then fuck you.
From the shadows of producing to the forefront of the horror world as a director, our guest tonight boasts a 40-plus year career in the film industry and whose body of work includes Society, Return of the Living Dead 3, and the film we're going to be speaking about tonight, Bride of Reanimator. So without further ado, I gladly introduce Brian Usna to the Rants from the Black Lodge podcast. Thank you so much, Brian, for sitting down with us to talk a little bit about what, in my estimation, is one of the most underrated sequels of all time, Bride of Reanimator.
Thanks, Brandon.
Well, my first question, unfortunately, has to do with your longtime collaborator who passed away earlier this year. A long, never forgotten, but dear to our hearts, Stuart Gordon. I'm curious as to why he did not return to the directing chair from the first film to this film.
Well, he was pretty busy, and at that time, his career could have really hit the stratosphere. And because we were working on Honey, I Shrunk the Kids then, and he was going to direct it. And so it could have been really big. His agent thought it wasn't good for him to do sequels.
Okay. Well, my follow up to did you always have your eye on the directing chair, or were you just the default, like, well, if Stuart's not going to do it, I'm going to be the one to take over the slot?
Oh, it's a little more complicated than that, but the short answer would be your first suggestion. The way I got into filmmaking isn't the way most people do today. It was different back then. We're talking the early 80s. I never went to school or took a class. I read books. I went to Hollywood because I wanted to do it professionally. Back then, you couldn't do it. I was living in North Carolina at that time. You couldn't even get people to show up on Saturday. People just wouldn't take it seriously. And with film, you have to take it. So I wanted to go to Hollywood and have people who were professionals. Stuart had never made a movie, but he had been directing theater for 12 years in Chicago. So even though it was his first movie, he really wasn't a first timer in a way. And certainly as a director, he wasn't. And I, you know, produced the first three movies that we did together, which was Reanimator, From Beyond, and Dolls. And Reanimator, I actually financed. So I borrowed the money and went way out on a limb. Once you're working on movies, on a movie set, probably half the people on that set kind of look at the director and go, gee, I think I could do that. You sort of want to start making those decisions. It's crazy. You know, a director, they say, what color should this wall be? And you'd say, I think red. And they go, he wants red. He said red. It's like whatever you say is important. And you get to make all these little choices. And so there is that. I bet if you talk to, you know, the head of the art department, the VP, so many people kind of look, actors, they go, God, I'd like to try direct. The other thing was that at that point, I started developing projects. And you have to understand, I was trying to make my living. I wanted to make my living making movies. That means you got to keep doing it, especially exactly. In the low end. I developed projects that then I couldn't get going because the director fell out. So one of them was a movie I called Dagon, which was an adaptation of Shadow Over Innsmouth. Stuart and I and Dennis had always thought that'll be the sequel to Reanimator. Because I didn't think of a sequel as having to have the same characters. I just thought it would be like the Corman Poe series. So then I had the whole thing financed in Wales. And when the time came to close the deal, Stuart had decided to stick with Empire to make Robot Jocks, which is a movie that I was producing at the beginning. But I ended up in a lawsuit against Empire for monies not paid on Reanimator. And so then I left any projects with them. Stewart kept on. So that deal fell apart. Then I was working with Dan O'Bannon, who had directed Return of the Living Dead.
Terrific.
And Alien. Yeah. He had an idea about a movie called The Men, about a woman who discovers that all men are aliens. And so we all jumped into, I was going to produce it. Dan was going to direct it. So at first it was going to be, well, how about if Stuart directs it? Dan writes it. And Dan said he wanted to direct it. Stuart said, no problem. And so Dan and I developed this thing for 8 months. And when the time, and I found the financing, when the time came to have the meeting to sign the papers, Dan backed out. So this was, you know, then there was the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, which we had that all ready to go. I had moved down to Mexico to shoot it. We were weeks away from shooting, and Stuart fell out for health reasons. And once that happened, then their insurance came in and a new director came on, and all of a sudden he has his own producer.
So you fell between the cracks.
That meant that I had been going through all these projects and they were falling out because the director falls out and then you don't have a project. But I wasn't experienced enough. I was I was totally new to the business, completely with no preparation, bouncing into walls. Then, as you said, I kind of thought, well, I wouldn't mind directing. And I told myself, well, then I'll be the one-stop shop. So that's what I decided to do, and found a friend who was making, had got financing from the Japanese to make some movies. I said, well, I want to direct one. And I said, but I'll let you finance Bride of Reanimator. I'm going to direct it. I want to control, want to produce and direct, but it has to be a two-picture deal. That has to be the second one, because I figured that being kind of a novice, I might direct a movie, it might be horrible. I might do a bad job because I don't know what I'm doing.
Thankfully, it didn't turn out that way.
Well, but that was the fear. And I thought, if I do that, it's like the French distributor once told me. He said, most directors make their first movie is two movies in one, their first and their last. And
sure, that's
probably true. You know, I've got to be careful that I don't, that I have another chance. So I figured I'll do the other one first, then I'll do Bride, because I know they'll have to do Bride because they really want it. And so that way, I've got two chances to kind of direct, not just one. So that was how it all came together.
And the other film, I'm assuming, would have been Society, correct?
Oh, it was Society. So then once we made that two-picture deal, then I looked for a script. And this writer came up to me one day in the office, says, here, look at my script, you know. And I read it, and it was the reason it struck me so, why I jumped on it, was because it had the same paranoia of The Men.
And The Men
covers all men are aliens. It's everywhere. Everything looks normal, but it's not. And she's freaking out, and everybody thinks she's crazy. And so that feeling of that when you scratch the surface of the world, of our reality, there's some weirdness underneath. That appealed to me. The original script of Society had that. It didn't have the fantastic stuff. It didn't have the shunting and all that. And since I'm a real fan of, it had basically a blood sacrifice cult at the end. But I'm a fan of special effects. I've always liked the surrealism in art. I've always liked transformations in the movies from the time I was a kid. I just, you know, I always like to watch the werewolf in stuff, yeah. in time lapse. You know, that's as good as it got back then. I always liked the Ray Harryhausen stuff. I like stuff with effects. And so I thought, I get a chance to direct a movie. I'm not going to do it with just like blood sacrifice. It's got to have something weird. And so then
you nailed that.
Surge, and we collaborated. We looked at Dali's stuff and we said, let's do this. And we worked with the writer, Woody Keith, who it was sort of based on his life, kind of the movie. He's from Beverly Hills and he kind of, and his partner, Rick Fry, kind of joined in with him. But we just worked together to incorporate these weird visuals. And I thought, what would I like to see that I haven't seen in the movies? And I thought, well, I'd like to see skin melding together. So I imagine these two people upstairs in the mansion, their skins are all melding together. And then I said, well, how do you get that? How do you get to that point? And so I just started back engineering the script so that it became just sort of a big ironic take on typical class politics and just to have fun with it, you know, and make it. It was kind of like making a new kind of monster, and I like that.
Well, being that you were so new to the directing field, I have kind of a two-part question. The first part being that you had, I guess, viewed the directing post from the producing perspective and had been on set so much, did you sort of learn the directing process sort of by osmosis of being around it? And secondly, what's the process of having to be the director and filming such outrageous special effects as opposed to maybe just a regular scene of two people talking? Because I have to imagine there's complications in the latter.
Yeah, I think I had made a amateur feature before I went to Hollywood. And that's what made me realize I wanted to find a director who knew what he was doing. So I had directed things. But I didn't know about actors. It was sort of this weird, you know, I didn't know how do you talk to them? What do they do, really? And so when I was on the set of, you know, when I worked with Stewart, I pretty much picked up you know, I paid a lot of attention to his directing. Not the part of directing that is make this frame, do this shot, you need a close up or whatever. It wasn't that. There's certain technical parts of directing that anybody can learn. But what Stewart knew how to do was tell stories with actors. And he knew how to talk to actors. He can act. And that's what he had done since high school. He'd been a director. And so I tried to learn from that to know how to deal with actors. I'm still all that good at it. You know, when it comes to shots and how you tell things visually with a camera, that I feel very comfortable with. And I've always felt very comfortable with effects. I always feel very comfortable with the effects guys, even though they often are very resentful of me because I'm very hard to please sometimes. With effects. So that was kind of how it came about. It was by being on sets, by being in that world. And at one point you just jump in the water and try to swim. Everybody does that. I guess in film school now, since everybody goes to film school now, I'm not sure. And you can watch YouTube videos to teach you anything. I'm not sure anything really prepares you for dealing with the actors except doing it. And I think there's an aptitude that maybe is very difficult to teach. I've dealt with actors. I've directed so many movies and I've dealt with actors, and sometimes successfully, sometimes not. Some people say the most important part of directing is casting. Because if you get good actors, you don't have to do much. But with somebody like Stewart, he could get inexperienced actors. He could bring out the best in the actors. He could get inexperienced actors. It wasn't like we were working with, you know, big names or anything. But
gotcha.
Stewart knew how to do it. And I watched that. And that's what I learned from him. I've produced probably 10 first-time directors. And I learn on all of them very quickly. I can predict how they're going to shoot a scene, except for one, Christoph Gans, who I made Necronomicon and Crime Freeman with, the French guy. He wasn't very good about telling story with actors. But every shot, every scene was based on another movie. It was all about the frame. Everything was an homage to something. Everything referenced, because he was a French critic. That's what they do. And I could never predict what he was going to do, because often I didn't know his references. But when I'd find the reference, I'd see that he was basically making his scenes based on other scenes. And I did use that. I learned that from him. And the first movie I made after I did two movies with him, I directed The Dentist, which was a super
Corbin Burnson. Great movie. Yeah.
And on that one, I did that. I was very careful about the framing. I was very careful about transitions. I planned every last and first shot of a transition of a scene, end of a scene, beginning of the next, wanted to make sure that I took into account how that was going to cut together. And when I had a killings, because I'd never done a movie that had body count before. And so we had to kill all these people. The dentist had to. And so I actually just went to Hitchcock movies and copied scenes from Hitchcock. And they're right there, you know. And so that's another kind of way of doing it. You know, everybody comes up with their own system. And if you're lucky, like Stewart, he was the most successful when he was basically dealing with actors. he doesn't do a lot of like, you don't, he doesn't sign every frame, and it's not pretend, it's not like self-conscious about how he's shooting. What he's all about is how the actors are telling.
He's allowing the actors to sell the scene.
Well, and he doesn't allow much. He does. But what I'm saying is that he doesn't let the actors change a word in this. Right? They can't change a word. Now, when I do it, I don't consider the script to be any kind of magic. I kind of want the act. A lot of times, a scene, some dialogue, I'm really not that sold on, but the actor can solve it by their performance. Sometimes I want the actor I'm open to suggestions. Of course, you want to do that before you're on the set. Stewart used to do lots of rehearsal. Well, when you're working as a producer, I could never ask the actors to come and rehearse for free. You could have them come over to dinner and then maybe read through the script, but you can't ask them that because you have to pay them for that. Whereas Stewart is a theater director, he doesn't even have that boundary. But then normally he was directing, not producing. Yeah. Normally I was producing and directing. So I was all not only contracting, but also being the one working with them. And then you have to be comfortable with doing all these. Even if you have the actors to rehearse, you've got to know how to do it. And I think that's very awkward especially when you begin directing. I certainly did that. I mean, I certainly started doing that more and more. And especially when I worked in Indonesia, I did a movie called Amphibious there. I was trying to make a line of pictures in Jakarta. And I did a movie about a giant sea scorpion. And I needed these kids to live on this fishing platform. The whole thing takes place on a fishing platform in the middle of the sea. It's just out of bamboo, you know. They really have those places. And so I needed all these kids because they make kids do it. It's kind of like child labor. And you can't get an actor in Indonesia. The actors are terrible. And so the casting director, you bring in kids from the schools. They had to speak English. And they were awful. It was impossible to even imagine. And so he went and got kids that actually didn't have any place to live. There's a lot of people that don't live, that live on the streets kind of in Jakarta.
Wow.
And brought in all these kids, and we picked four of them, or five, and we gave them a place to live, and I kind of explained to them how a movie is shot, taught them English enough so they could say their lines, and rehearsed a lot with them so that they could do it. So I have gotten to that. I don't know how it's easier when you're dealing with people who are totally ignorant. But if I was having to deal with like substantial actors, I'd be embarrassed. I would feel like, oh, I'm not good enough. Or, you know, I don't know how to, you know, it's tough to set up the rehearsals. If you're not, I think when you come from theater, that's what you do.
Yeah.
And I think in film school now, they teach people how to do that. They really teach them how to do it. Now, some people will never be able to direct a movie because it's like, well, who is that basketball player that they were asking about whether he could teach whether this young rookie that's really talented, whether he'd be able to teach him how to play, you know, how to play in the NBA. And he says, yeah, I can teach him, but I can't teach basketball IQ. Some people just get the game. And I think in film, I've noticed it's the same because I have a partner we often act as producers' reps for people who are making, you know, micro-budget movies from Tennessee, say, right?
Yeah.
And they're going to shoot their damn movie. And they'll contact me. Say, well, can you look at my movie and all this? And I'll say, well, you know what? When you make another one, let me know ahead of time, and I'll give you some advice. And then my partner and I, we will be a producer's rep, and we'll help you make the deals for the, you know, for the distribution and all this, and we'll help you make it more professional, and maybe you'll get your money back. Because if you make your money back, you can make a business out of it. But if you just go, you know, helter skelter, and you end up with something that it's a hobby. And I think people really want to have an audience for their movies. And you can't have an audience unless you're in the distribution system.
Yeah.
And if you're in the distribution system, it's got to bring money in. And that means probably you're going to make some money. So that's a business. I think most people, they want to make movies and make money, not just have a hobby that nobody ever looks at. So anyway, we do that, but sometimes somebody they'll shoot the hell out of stuff, but you get the feeling that no matter what you say on the script and the shooting level, you have the feeling that they're just not going to understand how you tell a story. What constitutes revealing a story on film or tape or whatever it is, digital? And I think that's something that, that's maybe movie IQ. And I think maybe there is a part of movie IQ you can't teach, that some people can't learn, you know. But I think if you go to film school, you figure that out. Not that I promote film school. I think you should just make movies and take it seriously if you want to do that. But if you can go to film school, it's a great way to make contact. The main thing with film school, I think, is that it gives people a bunch of people who are doing the same thing they're doing that they can call on, who are taking it seriously, or, you know, and you're not just with your friends and you're the one that's kind of into movies and the other guy's into God knows what, you know.
Now, a little earlier, you had mentioned about how the differences between how, you know, Stewart would cast good actors and then maybe not have to do so much. Well, you have some carryover actors from Reanimator returning in this movie. And I have to say, Jeffrey Combs and Bruce Abbott are absolutely phenomenal. They have great chemistry in the first movie, but I feel like their chemistry is almost even better in Bride of Reanimator because there's a... what am I trying to say? There's a familiarity between them because they've done this before. Now, I'd like for you to confirm or deny this, but there was a rumor that Jeffrey Combs almost did not return from this movie because of a scheduling conflict. Is there any truth to this? And if he had not come back, did you have anybody in mind to fill the role of Dr. Herbert West?
Yeah, it was, you know, the thing about Bride was, I mean, it's a typical movie story, but it sounds crazy. And that is that in January of that year, I think it was 89, I was working on a script with Dennis Paoli and Stuart Gordon for Bride of Reanimator. And in that version, Herbert West and Dan Cain are working in a mortuary. And the only character from that version that came over was the character that I was determined to have in the movie. And that was the finger eye creature.
So love it. Absolutely love it.
I just wanted to have in a movie. And so I insisted on it. But that was the only thing that carried over. And when my friends got the financing, it was a company called Wild Street Pictures, and it was financed by Japanese. Back then, the Japanese kind of had all the money. And they were going to put up the money, but the money had to be his production had to start in the first week of June. It was, I don't know why, but when money talked.
Quick turnover.
So I talked to Stuart and Dennis, and I said, look, we need this script because I've got to shoot in June. And Stuart said, no, we can't do it. It's going to take 6 months. Of course, he was also doing another project. And I said, I can't wait 6 months. And Stuart didn't see the sense in that. So I basically paid him and said, okay, I'm just going to move on. And I got the writers of Society, and I called them over. And we started having late night meetings at my house. And we just came up with a whole new tape. I said, let's just start from the beginning and come up with a whole new project. And in fact, we, from I think it's February, March, April, within a couple, 2.5 or 3 months, we wrote the script. And on May 1st was our first day of production. Pre-production.
Yeah. Wow.
So we needed a script on May 1st, and then we had 5 weeks before we shot. And
Basically,
it was the first draft. The first time we printed a draft was on May 1st. It was over. The people were in the office waiting for a script, and we were down at the coffee center getting the copy to bring it in. And so the script is, there's a number of things we maybe didn't quite solve that are kind of goofy in the middle, you know. But it's kind of a first draft in a way. It's, you know, but I was determined to make the movie. And sometimes you got to do it whether everything makes sense or not. And so now we had to cast. We started casting, and we had at the first scene we were going to have the end of Reanimator, where we see what happens when Meg comes back to life.
Yeah.
And so but Barbara Crampton didn't want to do it. I think it was seemed too small for her, to her or something. She didn't really, you know, she's doing something else. And Jeffrey and Bruce was on board. And even back in like March, David Gale called me up and said, hey, I hear you're doing another Reanimator. I said, yeah. And he said, what's in it for me? That's what the actors always say. What's in it for me? Who do I play? And I said, God, David, you know, your head was squished and thrown against the wall. I don't know. Your body blew up. And he said, hey, no. I can come up with something. And I thought, man, he wants to do it. And
yeah, that's
some
awesome.
Of the actors I'm contacting kind of aren't that enthusiastic. Now, Bruce was on board. And so Jeffrey was not going to do it. And I had to just decide, well, if Jeffrey's not going to do it, who's going to do it? So we'll start casting. And the guy that I kind of had in mind was, I think he was the guy who played Petri in Society.
So oh, really? Okay. Yeah.
So he would have been okay. He wouldn't have been Jeffrey Combs. But I would have just pressed through. I don't know. I had to do it, you know.
Yeah.
I got to feed my family, you know. But it didn't last long. Jeffrey decided he could. And he came on board and was 100% in. And he and Bruce were just, had a great time. Of course, I took a dip, and the scene we shot with another, you know, with Meg, we didn't use because one, we had too many beginnings to the movie. You know, we had.
There's a lot going on at the beginning, so I can understand that.
So we cut that one, you know, a lot because we didn't have Barbara in it. And that was just sort of the straw that breaks the back. I wasn't completely crazy about the effect, but it was good, you know. So we had all these openings for the movie, and we needed to strip them down. And so we stripped a lot. We stripped a couple scenes out. And we had a, you know, we just went forward. So we were driving, we were blasting forward on that movie and trying to figure out how to do it all at the same time. And, you know, one of the things that I did, of course, is Stuart liked to, he prefers to use effects that he can do on stage, you know. And I like, back then it was called green screen, and, you know, I like special effects. So I wanted special effects. So you notice with the finger eye creature, from one shot to another, it's like four different special effects, you know. It's just,
I absolutely love it.
Motion, it's real fingers, it's a stop motion with a rear screen projection of the lab. It's a pull toy. It's somebody holding a stick and doing that. So one of the things I found with special effects was that if you, people always think they don't work. Well, they don't work. They're called special effects because usually they don't work. It's something you're trying to do that isn't normal. And so, but that doesn't bother me, because I always figure you can find a way to make it work just for the camera, you know, just for that angle. And so I always learned that if you, you know, it's all made out of rubber, latex and methacellulose. I mean, that's back in the 80s. That's what the guys did. They just like carved maquette. They carved things out of clay, made a mold out of it, poured the mold with foam rubber. You know, they would make like the face of somebody out of stone, out of chalk. And then they would make the appliance. And then they'd cook the appliance. And they'd paint the appliance. And then they'd put it on the guy. And, you know, so everything was done kind of like that. But so it never really looks that great. And it's the puppeting that really is the best. Puppeting is what really brings it to life. But I found that if it didn't look good, it kind of put some goop on it.
And then, I got you that way.
Get the camera down and put some goop on it, and then throw in some smoke and some blinking lights, and that maybe even a colored light, and then it starts looking okay. A little strobe and some goop, and the goop is like reflecting, and it just looks better. And you just keep doing it until it looks like something for a few seconds. And so, but then, you know, I think that I just feel like you just keep doing it. So I just wanted to have effects. And I found that if you mix up the style of the effect from shot to shot, if you do three of them, people, they quit figuring it out.
So you're cheating the eye. It's almost like a magician.
You watch Harryhausen, and it is great. But you know it's stop motion. It's always stop motion. And so I think it's better if you, not always, if it's a close up, you know, when King Kong has to pick up the girl, it's a real hand, you know.
Yeah.
Not the, you know, but it's, you know, it's up to me. I would have King Kong in a suit in stop motion with puppet, but just do it different ways. And you start losing track of how it was done, and you just buy it more. I mean, you know, it's fake. You're not trying to fool somebody into think that really exists. You just want it. You want them not to think about how it was done and just have fun with what's there. So that was one thing I did, was try to do more special effects. And the other thing I did is I wanted it to be more operatic. I wanted it to be grand, you know. So I made the laboratory with the art director. We thought, well, let's just build this laboratory, the basement, and to make it seem grand, you can't have a basement with great in a great hall. But if you put big, heavy timbers above, it makes it seem like something, you know. And we did this. Sets were designed for each shot. And I you know, instead of having Jeffrey and Bruce be all so well shorn, so, you know, I thought they'd been to war. Bruce, I put him in a blouse. He's like kind of romantic. Kind of let his hair be long, you know. And Jeffrey, I wanted to put a gun on his hip, you know, because I think Wes, I always thought Wes should have a gun, you know, and make him, and he, his hair's even longer. So everything was a little, you know, there was a different point of view from that, you know.
Well, one of the things I really like about the movie is that it does have somewhat of a tonal shift, a little more in the comedy direction. And I wanted to ask you, was this intentional to make things a little more, you know, tongue in cheek and fun, as opposed to more of the occasional comedy in the first film?
Yeah, of course it was. And actually, the comedy in the first film, it wasn't really intentional. Stuart never wanted it to be funny, but he naturally is a funny guy. But not all his movies are funny. If you look at Stuck, it's not funny, you know. But when we were making Reanimator, even working on the script, you know, the original script didn't have Dr. Hill in it. And then I read the stories. I said, hey, there's this guy that carries his head around. I want to see that, because that's horror, right?
Yeah.
Horror movie has a headless guy and a head that talks. And so I thought, man, I want that. And so we brought that so that he was included as the bad guy. And I remember when we were discussing about the head giving head, as Dennis called it. And we said, okay, he's headless, but what's he going to do to it? We said, well, the only thing he can. You know, and so that was, and to have a line like get a job in a sideshow, and those are funny lines, and we were having fun with it, you know, with the whole thing. And I think that, and I think that, you know, Stuart directed it that way. I mean, when you have the scene with the cat, and then West says, look out, Dan. And when Dan is scared, West laughs at him. Oh, that's funny. It's done in a way that makes you laugh at the character. It's not done like, it doesn't make you feel, God, he's just, it's not like Henry Porter, serial killer, you know. I don't think Stuart could have directed Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer that way, because he would have just made it more ironic. I guess his Henry is that King of the Ants. But King of the Ants has goofy stuff, you know. But it is pretty bleak. It's very bleak, unlikable character, you know. I don't think Stuart intended it to be funny. He said he didn't. He thought it was going to be scarier than it was. Well, a lot of people thought it was scary. We just didn't. I never thought it was scary, you know. But I thought it was a great, fun horror movie, which is what I like about horror, is when it's just entertaining, you know. And I think that, and after it, when we were doing From Beyond, I remember at one point Stuart said to me, you know, they really like the funny stuff in Reanimator. Let's make sure we put funny stuff in this.
Okay.
Going off the audience. What is the audience like? Dennis Paoli told me once, he said, you know, because he knew Stuart when they were kids, right? He's been with Stuart the whole ride in college and high school. And he said, you know, and they'd done plays, and he said, you know, Stuart and I could have done anything. You just wanted to do horror. So we did horror because I had the money. And it's not that they didn't have that project. They already had a script for a Reanimator pilot then. And that's what we developed into the movie. It's not that Stuart couldn't do horror. It's just that he also did sci-fi and did comedy, did Bleacher Bums, which is a incredible play that he and his group did way back when. It still plays. And, you know, I remember some of the projects he would show me. They'd be about cops and they'd be all these things. But Dennis said, you're the guy that wanted to do horror. And then when I wanted to do horror, I wanted it to be hardcore, because when we started shooting, I thought that I knew, I decided, not all, I love horror. I'm a fan. But I also know that it's horror fans are, you know, they will hang in there with you even if the movie's not real good. Like, I know I'm a horror fan because I love all movies, everything. You name it, I love it. But, like, give me a romantic comedy, it's got to be a real good one. It's not a real classic. I don't like it. I can't watch it. But with horror, I can watch dog shit and enjoy it. You know, because I'm a horror fan. That's what tells me. I can watch some crappy, cheap thing and get a kick out of it. Boring thing, just get a kick out of it. So I know that I've seen a lot of these independent horror movies, cheap horror movies, which is what Reanimator was. And I've seen that a lot of times they try to be respectable. Like, they're worried about what their parents are going to think, or I don't know what their neighbor, or, you know. And I noticed that a lot of times those things, they pull back on the exploitation. And I thought, man, that's the kiss of death, because it's never going to be good enough for the mainstream. But if you don't put the exploitation, you're going to lose the hardcore audience. And those are the people you can depend on. And so that was part of going into it. I said, let's go for broke with the exploitation, which was perfect, because that's what Stuart likes to do anyway. It's not like I really had to push.
My final question is actually sort of in the realm of what you were just saying. A lot of your films have a similarity in kind of pushing the boundaries, which as a horror fan, I absolutely love, especially being a, you know, younger when I saw these things. And you've said, you know, the head giving head, that was hysterical to me. I didn't really know why when I was seven, why it was funny, but it was. And society is just nuts. And there are things in Bride of Reanimator that are just so bizarre. And I know that horror has always kind of had a negative connotation when it comes to critics and parent groups, church groups. And a lot of these films that you worked on, that the formative ones, are pre-social media. Well, now we live in a social media age where everything is held under a microscope, and there's Twitter mobs, and, you know, people are trying to retroactively call things out for being problematic. And I'm curious, being that you have had this creative position of bringing so many nightmares to fruition, where do you stand on this kind of pushback of people whose sensibilities are maybe shaken by the work you've done?
I don't know. I'm not trying to defend, you know, spilling blood in the movies, you know, bread and circus, you know, it's entertainment. I don't know. To me, it's very entertaining. When I was a kid, I loved horror movies. I loved ghost stories. I loved to read ghost stories, hear ghost stories, watch horror movies. And I watched everything else too, but I loved it. And it wasn't, you know, in a way you can say, you know, put the violence up on screen where it belongs, you know, people running the streets with automatic weapons, kind of acting bullyish. And that's pretty obscene, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this year has been terrible for things like that.
It's like a theme park ride, you know, you're totally safe. It's all going to be okay. I remember watching a huge hit movie, which was Risky Business.
With Tom Cruise?
It was with Tom Cruise. And it was such a big hit, and the critics loved it. Everybody loved it. And I always remember watching it and going, man, this kid is bringing hookers to his house and being a pimp to make money. And then the school he's trying to get into thinks that's good because that's what they need. Kind of done ironically, but people were digging. It was money, 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 you know. It was, and I'm kind of going, it's really a fun movie, but part of me is kind of going, whoa, you know, this is interesting what's going on in our culture, you know. It's that greed is good thing. And there's a lot of that in the movies. It's like there's no So yeah, I can see how you can certainly pick apart all this stuff. And I guess I'm just glad that there wasn't social media during my time, because I don't really deal with it. I personally don't want to really be a public character at all. I don't want that. I don't want people to know what I'm eating, you know.
Yeah.
I don't want them to know where I am. I like to be able to have some kind of presence with fans of horror movies and stuff, because I know what they're relating to, and they like the stuff I like, and they like what I do, and I'd like to be somebody to them. I'll go on your thing, because I presume whoever watches it are probably, I like to talk about Bride of Reanimator. It's a hell of a lot of fun to me.
I thoroughly enjoy it, and I hope that the people that haven't seen it will give it a shot after hearing our conversation.
Come on down to Mask by Lance, premium Friday the 13th custom-made hockey mask down there in Tennessee by Lance McKinney. Find him on Facebook and Instagram over at Mask by Lance. Go order one now, boy! Yee-hoo!
Next Generation Wrestling brings some of the most talked about and star-studded professional wrestlers from around the world. Based out of East Tennessee, NGW is becoming one of the most sought-after independent wrestling promotions in the past 4 years. Witness NGW Live or on demand on the High Spots Wrestling Network streaming app. Follow us on social media platforms at NextGenTN.
Alright, Ran Army, it's time to throw on your Miskatonic University sweatshirt, grab your copy of the Cthulhu Mythos, and crack open a fresh vial of reagent. That's right, tonight we're going to tread the waters of H.P. Lovecraft. Well, kind of, but not really. The film that we're talking about tonight, well, it's a sequel to a movie that has its roots in the Lovecraft mythos. This film, of course, that we're talking about and spotlighting tonight is the 1990 graphically explicit, blood-soaked, mega-gross-out classic Bride of Reanimator. Classic to some, bullshit to others, but we will cross that bridge when we come to it. I am your host, Brandon A. Lane, and my singular goal tonight is to convince the naysayers to give this film a second chance and outright convince those who have never seen it for whatever reason. Well, you need to check out this often forgotten sequel and give it a go. So let's hit the ground running. Bride of Reanimator was released in the United Kingdom July 8th, 1990, but it didn't see its full United States release until December 31st of that same year, New Year's Eve. Odd time to release a film. Had an estimated budget of $2 million, and you can see every penny of it on screen. Amazing creature work that we're going to dissect in more detail a little later on. Now, the box office is where this gets interesting. I had to dive deep and just crawl through the weeds to even get a number, so take this with a grain of salt, because there's no guarantee this is 100% accurate, but I got the number of $2.2 million. Not great. That means this movie had a profit of $200,000. Now, I have to imagine when this got released on VHS that it made more, way more, but it had a limited window of opportunity to be in theaters, and this has to be seen as a loss. So, unfortunately, that is what it is. However, IMDb has Bride of Reanimator ranked at a 6.3 out of 10, which I found surprising, because this film, for whatever reason, has somewhat of a negative connotation to it, which is reflected in its Rotten Tomatoes score. 44% rotten, and its audience score is 45%. Our friends at Shudder, a little more how in line I would feel about it, 4.3 out of 5. I don't know that I would quite go that high, but that's definitely in the butter zone for me. And our Google users, as always, come through with the most accurate of numbers, 90%. For me, I would put it around the 85%. But, you know, at that point, you're just splitting hairs. On Fat Tony's hit list, we have 10 cold corpses, or sometimes they're a little warm because they've been reanimated.
this also is a number that is contested, because during that insane finale, when, you know, the mausoleum is just closing in and the walls are crashing through on everybody, it's possible there are more dead bodies, but I was only able to confirm 10. Unless you include Francesca's dog, which that would make it 11. And I know some people hate seeing animals get killed on screen. However, this is one of the highlights of the film for me, and we'll talk about it when it pops up. On Stank Dick Eddie's Titty Tally, this is one of the most strange numbers we've ever had in this. We have 1.5. So, Kathleen Kinmont, who plays our bride, you full-on see the glory of her titties that you did not see in Halloween 4. Damn you, Kelly Meeker, getting us all hot and bothered with Cops Do It by the Book, and them things just unfurled, but you don't see the nipples, which is exactly why we have a 0.5, because Francesca, the character who is the love interest of Dan Cain, you see the boobies, but you don't see the nipples, so I gave it a half rating on that. So, moving on. Last month, during our 3-year anniversary spectacular, we introduced a new segment where we took a look at other horror movies that came out in a particular year, and we broke down financially where our spotlighted film, which in case of to this episode is Bride of Reanimator, and where it would rank in terms of that year's box office. So let's check out Bride of Reanimator's stiff competition. So let's break it down. These are the films that came out in 1990. This isn't a comprehensive list. These are just the big ones that you would more than likely have seen or heard of. Tremors, Tales from the Dark Side of the Movie, Two Evil Eyes, Slumber Party Massacre 3, Nightbreed, Night of the Living Dead remake, directed by Tom Savini. Great movie. Misery, not exactly a horror film, but you know, definitely in the horror thriller category. So it makes the list for me. Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3, which is available in our archive, so go check it out at juicykruger.com with an interview with our good buddy Mick Strawn. Jacob's Ladder, which every horror-based survival video game has completely ripped off. Silent Hill. we got Gremlins 2, yet again, a little more in the campy comedy category, but it's definitely of the same ilk genre film. Graveyard Shift. Frankenhooker, which is available in the archives as well, but don't listen to that episode. It's garbage. This is back before we knew what we were doing with this podcast. Frankenstein Unbound, very underrated. And when you're talking about underrated, this movie is celebrating its 30-year anniversary, and that being Exorcist 3. Absolutely banger of a film. And we have Child's Play 2. Now, before we talk about box office totals, I figured it would be instructive to relay the information that both It, the Tommy Lee Wallace miniseries, and Psycho 4, they were both released this year, and they were both successful, but they were made for TV films, so they're ineligible, and so because they didn't have any box office returns. Otherwise, they would definitely be on this list. And bear in mind that 1990 is that direct-to-video era, so we have a lot of other films that just went straight to video, and they're ineligible for this participation in stiff competition as well. So, I'm going to give you our top five, and I'm going to ponder a question to the audience right now, and talk amongst yourselves to figure out your answer. But where do you think, based off of what I've told you, Bride of Reanimator would say rank in the top five, or would it be in there at all? Well, let's break it down. Number five, Jacob's Ladder with $26.1 million. Coming in at number four, we have Child's Play 2, with $35.8 million. Coming at number three, Exorcist 3 with $39 million. Coming at number two, Gremlins 2 with $41.5 million. And taking the top spot for 1990, as far as horror cinema goes, this is probably going to ruffle the feathers of some of you purists out there who don't think this is a horror movie, but I'm going to give it the top spot because it earned it. That being Misery, $61.3 million. So let's break down the other numbers we have here. Tremors made $16 million, a lot more than I actually thought it did. Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, made $16.3 million. Two Evil Eyes, didn't even make $1 million. $349,618. Now, that's another movie I know did way better on VHS. Slumber Party Massacre 3, $1.2 million. Good for them. our good buddy who stopped by the Black Lodge to participate in our People Under the Stairs episode, Jan Birch. He plays a substantial role in that film as the creepy guy in the background. That's not a knock on that. He does that role very well. Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3 made $5.7 million. Graveyard Shift, $11.6 million. Frankenhooker, and this is sad too, $205,068. Frankenhooker is a classic, and we're going to have to revisit that because I just did not do that movie justice. That's the first episode we did with fucking Judd Kelly. I know he hasn't been on the podcast in a while, but he was intimidated in his personality, which is so boastful and wonderful most of the time, just didn't come through in that. And to be honest with you, the research, or lack thereof, just was not up to snuff with how I like to present these episodes. So you heard it here first. Sooner or later, we're going to do Frankenhooker again. Another Frankenstein-related film, Frankenstein Unbound, made $335,000 yet again. Ooh, big bomb. So let's, before we move on from this, I want to say, in this year, we had three films that are Frankenstein-esque in their presentation. We have Bride of Reanimator, we have Frankenstein Unbound, and we have Frankenhooker. So I just want to know, what was in the water of 1989 leading into 1990, where everybody was kind of in the mood for some old school stitch a lady together or stitch a man together and reanimate him kind of movie. I'm not exactly sure. I just thought that was interesting that there were so many in such a short span. Now, Bride of Reanimator was by no means the highest grossing film of 1990, but does support a legacy as a fan favorite among gore hounds, and that's a big asterisk with it. This is why a lot of fans do like this movie, and a lot of people don't. I know there's a crossing line of what is good in a horror film, but if you ask me, the over-the-top special effects in this movie are absolutely the star. And it's cemented its place in the pantheon of cult horror cinema, but before we can dissect the film at hand, we need to talk about the road that led to its production. So let's go from page to screen. So immediately following the success of 1985's Reanimator, several attempts to produce a sequel were made. One idea for a sequel involved Dan Cain, who is played by Bruce Abbott in the original and this film, taking a job of a building superintendent as a cover to continue working on reanimating Meg Halsey, who was played by Barbara Crampton in the original film. And this would lead the government to discovering his whereabouts, and they would whisk him away to the White House, where he would be reunited with mad scientist Herbert West, and he would be instructed to reanimate the President of the United States. Now, if this premise sounds familiar, it's because during the George W. Bush presidency, it was nearly produced under the title House of Reanimator and would have been the fourth film in the series, following Beyond Reanimator, which, less we say about it, the better. However, the decision was made by former producer and now director Brian Usna and writers Woody Keith and Rick Frey to ground the narrative in a kind of a twisted love story with Frame, loosely based off of 1935's Bride of Reanimator. Great film, and definitely not a bad direction to take a Reanimator film in. And I like that this film kind of deviates from, because this movie isn't so much about reanimating, it's more about creating life, which is definitely in the Prometheus narrative of, the novel of Frankenstein, and a little bit in the films. But that idea is of creating life and kind of conquering, mankind conquering God, in a sense, is interesting direction to take it in. And there's some pontification of the Herbert West character, particularly in this film, where he gets to, monologue about, God sits on his throne and doesn't do anything, and he doesn't care about you, and I am the architect of life, and great stuff. So pre-production for Bride of Reanimator began in early 1989. Production on the film was scheduled to begin on June 5th, 1989, which left the filmmakers with less than a month to finalize the script. That is never a good sign when you have to rush the script. Now, we'll talk about the pacing issues and some of the things that could have been restructured, but we'll just pin that from the moment. They had to finish hiring the cast and crew, get the special effects underway, Jeffrey Combs was initially not going to reprise his role as Herbert West due to a scheduling conflict, because he was already booked to film in Italy for Pit and the Pendulum, which is directed by the original Reanimator director, Stuart Gordon. Great film, just got it on Blu-ray from Full Moon. Great transfer. Thankfully, on May 25th, 1989, production of The Pit and the Pendulum was pushed back, and Combs was immediately cast to return to his most iconic role. So let's talk about that for a second. How do you make Reanimator without Jeffrey Combs? And I love David Gale. I love Bruce Abbott. And it's great to have Usna coming back, you know, going from the producer role to the directing seat. But how do you make this movie without your most iconic character or the most iconic actor behind the character? To me, this was almost a situation where, you know, like Nightmare on Elm Street 2, where they cast a guy that wasn't Robert Englund, and thankfully cooler heads prevailed and they swept that shit under the rug and got Robert back to save the sinking ship. I love Jeffrey Combs so much, and he's such a consummate professional that you have to think that, you know, he obviously he wanted to do this, so it wasn't beneath him. It wasn't a money issue. It was a scheduling issue. And I realized that, you know, you get these opportunities to make films, especially if you're taking your entire crew, you know, to other places and moving around. It's a money is time situation. But to do this movie without Jeffrey Combs, I think they would have damned themselves to, you know, the bargain bin forever. And as good as the special effects are, you need the characters in between to tie everything together. So I'm glad that there was a window of opportunity and he did the movie. And, you know, Jeffrey Combs was on this wonderful ride of 1980s and 90s supremacy between, you know, horror films and Empire Pictures and then his stints on Star Trek. He's as iconic as the brand itself. So glad that they got Jeffrey Combs back into the role. Broader Reanimator, while not a critical or financial success upon its release, Bride of Reanimator was nominated for two awards by the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films in 1991. It was nominated for a Saturn Award for Best Horror Film, and Jeffrey Combs, of course, was nominated for a Saturn Award for Best Supporting Actor. I want to talk about that a little bit. I don't know what won that year. I should have looked that up. Number one, fuck Best Supporting Actor. He should have been up for Best Actor. I know the whole story really centers around Dan Cain. He's our lead, but fuck that noise. Jeffrey's the one doing all the heavy lifting when it comes to, you know, the performing end. And that's not a knock on Bruce Abbott in the least, but I think he should have been nominated for Best Actor because coming back into the role, he's a little more comfortable with it. He brings a lot of gravitas to what very well may be a weaker script, but he's definitely having fun. And the other thing is, like, if he was up for Best Supporting Actor, fuck, he should have won it. I don't know who possibly could have in this year given a performance that would have outweighed the wonderfulness that is Jeffrey Combs, but I call foul, sir. I call foul. Going back to Bride of Reanimator. In subsequent years, it's been somewhat reevaluated as somewhat of a minor comedy horror classic and has been praised for its creative special effects from its A-list team of gore wizards, and we're going to talk about them a little later. So let's read the synopsis. The mad Dr. West, Jeffrey Combs. The tormented Dr. Dan Cain, Bruce Abbott. And the beheaded villain, Dr. Carl Hill, David Gale, return in this blood-soaked sequel to Reanimator, the most deliriously outrageous horror movie of the decade. That may be an understatement. It's been 8 months since the Miskatonic Massacre stained the hospital halls with blood, and Dr. West and Dan Cain's experiments have taken a bizarre turn. Now they have gone beyond reanimating the dead into the calm and realm of creating new life. The legs of a hooker, the womb of a virgin, and are joined by the heart of Dan Caden's dead girlfriend. The bride is unleashed upon her mate in the climax of sensual horror. I don't know that I would say sensual. There's some definitely sexual vibes going off during that that end scene, but sensual is not really what comes to mind. You know, normally this would be the part of the retrospective where we'd break down all the cast and crew in detail, and don't worry, that isn't going to deviate from that formula. However, it'd be a good idea for you to go back into the archives and check out our Reanimator episode, because a lot of the principal characters are absolutely the same. You've got Brian Usna, Jeffrey Combs, Bruce Abbott, David Gale. Anyway, we give a whole big over view of just H.P. Lovecraft as a whole. So what I would like you to do, because you're not going to get it in this episode, I want you to go back, if you want breakdowns of Jeffrey Combs and those guys in detail, I want you to go back in the archives, juicykruger.com, and check out that Reanimator episode, because that's one of the better episodes that me and Fat Fuck Scott have done together. We're still doing running commentaries at the time, but we're starting to structure things where you're still getting a comprehensive, in-depth, deep dive into those characters. It's impossible to review this film without discussing them, but just be forewarned that I'm going to do more of an overview than a deep dive on specific characters. Now, I'm going to try and go deeper with our new additions to the cast, but the majority of the talking points for this episode are going to focus on the real stars of Bride of Reanimator, and that being the kills and the amazing special effects. So first things first, let's briefly talk about our stars. Resuming the roles from the original Reanimator, we have Dr. Herbert West, played by Jeffrey Combs, with Bruce Abbott in the role of Dr. Dan Cain. And unfortunately, the underutilized David Gale gets to shine, but in a very, very small role compared to all the things he got to do in the original. He plays the role of Dr. Carl Hill. And, well, more specifically, the reanimated head of Dr. Carl Hill, one of the better aspects of the film. First thing I want to talk about is the chemistry between Jeffrey Combs and Bruce Abbott. It's pretty clear in the first film that they had lightning in the bottle, because they gelled together so well, and they're so opposite of one another, but they kind of complement each other in ways. I love in this film that Dan is, he gets indignant, and he wants to walk away so much, but it just takes the slightest bit of, you know, that methodical convincing from Herbert West to get him to come back. So there's almost a pinky in the brain kind of quality between them. Bruce Abbott is not a moron like Pinky, but I mean, I'm just saying, like, the ability for him to talk him into anything, it's definitely there. You really realize how important Bruce Abbott is to the series in this movie, more so than in the first one. Because the first film, you've got the great performances by David Gale and Jeffrey Combs, and then you've got Barbara Crampton in the mix. There's more set dressing as far as the actors go, but this film, without Barbara Crampton, her presence is, you know, omni. She's definitely the driving force of the film, even though she's not in it, but that the whole heart, you know, Dan Cain wants to utilize the heart to seemingly bring Megan Halsey back, but you really get a lot of Bruce Abbott in this film, showing what he can do, because he carries most of the narrative on his back. And I know I don't want to talk about Beyond Reanimator a lot. Every film successively has lost an element that made the first film great, because, you know, you've got your three leads, Barbara Crampton, Jeffrey Combs, and Bruce Abbott, and you lose Barbara Crampton in the sequel, but then you get to Bride Reanimator and you've lost Dan Cain, Bruce Abbott as well, and they need each other, because it's the sum of the whole. They just the camaraderie that especially those two characters have in Jeffrey Combs and Bruce Abbott. They try to do that stuff in Beyond Reanimator, and it just doesn't work, because it's like a guy reading off a script, and the reactions that you get between those two characters, being Dan Cain and Herbert West, is what makes their banter all the more satisfying. Because even if he doesn't agree with it, it's just the reactions to the shitty little snide things that Herbert West says back to him, or the brief moments of, like, the humanity shining through West when Dan says something, you know, so wholly heartfelt. They're great together, and that's one of the stronger aspects of Bride of Reanimator, is that you still have that core relationship. Now, the thing that this movie is lacking is we have no Barbara Crampton. She is so sorely missed in this movie, and that's not a knock on either of the female leads in this movie, but come on, you're not Barbara Crampton. Barbara Crampton, she's so angelic in the original film, and she serves all the purposes that the characters in this movie serve, but just in a way better manner. And it's not a knock on those, that we'll talk about them in a few moments, but okay, so they shot an entirely different opening of this film, and it didn't get used. And it's very similar to the ending of Reanimator, where, you know, Megan Halsey is, you know, being given the reagent, and it doesn't go well. But you would see, added on to that, you have Dan Cain administering the reagent to a stand-in, because Barbara Crampton decided she did not want to shoot this scene because her manager, I guess, had convinced her that it would be beneath her to just shoot a full-fledged cameo. And I think in subsequent years, she's probably regretted it, just for the simple fact of getting everybody back together one last time. But, I mean, it would have been very, very short. And then you would have Combs coming in, and, you know, of course, saying some smart-ass thing, you know, very cold-hearted, pun intended. But her declining to do the film definitely hurts it. It's a shame that they killed her off at all in the first movie, because I think the magic is those three. I mentioned this a little earlier, but she is definitely omnipresent in the film, even though she's not physically there. The entire point is that, you know, Dan is just rattled from the whole Miskatonic University, especially losing the love of his life. Not that his dick has been used any less in the meantime, because he gets down with some hot Italian babes, and you can even tell, like, it's like his head, his dick and his heart are split. He's given his dick to Francesca, and he's given his heart to Gloria, but neither of them fill the void. So yeah, the driving force of the movie is definitely, it literally is Barbara Crampton's heart. Megan Halsey's heart is the driving force of the movie. Now, one of my favorite lines of dialogue from the film has, you know, those great scenes where Wes is trying to convince Dan to continue work, and his ace in the hole is Megan Halsey's heart that he got from the evidence locker, which I'm not really sure why an evidence locker would be at a hospital, but that's, you know, stretch your imagination and make it work. And Dan he's reluctant, and he kind of laments to Dr. Wes, saying, "Well, what about the cops?" And Herbert replies, "The cops will never come here." Now, immediately following this exchange of dialogue, Lieutenant Chapman rings the doorbell. I've seen this movie like 50 times, and Bruce and Jeffrey's reaction at that moment that the doorbell rings makes me laugh every single time. Now, the comedy in Bride of Reanimator is very broad. It doesn't always work. But every time that those two are on screen, they are so funny. And it's just reactions. And I know the hallmark of any good actor is not acting, it's reacting. And just the reactions that they give each other for their actions is just so funny. There's a part later on where Bruce is reintroduced to Francesca. And the way the shot is framed, Bruce and Francesca are having Dan Cain and Francesca are having this conversation, and then Herbert just kind of slides in from the left, or from left into the frame, just, you know, the very edge, and he says, "Don't let the little head rule the big head," and then he just walks off. And it little things like that just make me absolutely squeal with joy, and that's going back to why they're so properly utilized with each other. However, I would say the one thing that is underutilized and not utilized to its potential is David Gale. Now, he steals the film, but he's in it so little that there are points in the movie where I completely forgot that he was even there. And that's not good. It can be used as a good thing in a better script to kind of forget about your antagonist. That way when they pop back up, you're like, oh shit. He almost seems tacked on. And at one point, they weren't even going to have him in the movie. It was going to be a completely different circumstance. And when David Gale heard that they were producing this film, he was like, no, you will put me in this movie. And I believe it was Brian Usna who told him, oh, okay, but you got to be a floating head. Oh, man. We'll get into the adding of the bat wings and everything a little later on. But the simple effect of a talking head, not the most spectacular of special effects, but, man, it is so effective. And his the way he stares off is so creepy. And he has his dialogue is almost like out of something out of the 1920s. You nincompoop. Very, very Dick Dastardly, twirling of the mustache, you know, tying a maiden to the railroad tracks kind of villain. But I absolutely adore. I adore him. So, moving on from our principal players, we have a few new fresh faces, and hot damn, what a face on our female lead, and I'm gonna butcher her name, Fabiana Udinio as Francesca Danelli, aka Dan Cain's love interest. If you are of my age range, you know this woman, because you've probably done things to yourself as a response to her appearances in 1980s and 90s cinema. So let's break it down. She's in Hard Bodies 2, which was a sex comedy of the 1980s. She's in RoboCop 2, very, very briefly, blink and you'll miss. In the Army Now, nobody wants to sell the many merits of Pauly Shore, but not the worst film he ever made. More contemporarily, people would know her as a lot of vagina in Austin Powers with Mike Myers, who was in Shrek with Eddie Murphy, who was in Trading Places with Dan Aykroyd, who was in Ghostbusters. You just got busted. And most recently, she had a reoccurring role on Jane the Virgin. I've never seen it, but you know, there's one other role that men of my age will remember her as, and that's the role of Anna Maria in Summer School. Now, I want to deviate just a moment to talk about Summer School. Not a horror movie, just a fun 80s flick with Mark Harmon. Although, I'm blanking on her name. She's in Nightmare on Elm Street 5. She's in People Under the Stairs. We just talked about her a couple of months ago. But yeah, she has a role in this film. But that's not why I want to single out Fabiana in this role as Anna Maria. So she's a foreign exchange student, and she's going to summer school with these, you know, this, you know, cast of strange characters. But there are these two gentlemen who are die-hard horror fans, and they introduce her to the wonders of horror cinema, in particularly Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Now, this movie has so much, street cred with fans of like 1980s movies, in particular horror fans, because of, you know, these three characters, because the idea that you could convert like a beautiful bombshell into a horror fan was as far-fetched, but you wanted to believe so much. She's very charismatic. You can't help but like her. She's very likable, but I feel like she is almost not necessary in Bride Reanimator. She's one of the weaker elements, and I hate to say that because every time she's on screen, she serves the movie, be there to condemn someone for their actions. But I feel like she's absolutely underwritten, and her narratively, her entire purpose in the film is to show up to react to bad things that are happening. That's good because you always want a pretty girl screaming in your monster movies. But I feel like they could have done a lot better. Now I'm going to talk a little more about her in this regard in the writing category when we get into our next character, because Francesca isn't the only love interest our conflicted hero has. We also have Kathleen Kinmont as Gloria / the bride. Now, she's in Hard Bodies Part 1, so her and Fabiana share a couple of the same franchises, which is, you know, kind of interesting. She's in Fraternity Vacation with Tim Robbins, and I don't know how I managed to bring this movie up so often, but it is something that gets brought up on the podcast from time to time. Stephen Jeffries and Amanda Bierce from Fright Night are also in Fraternity Vacation. It's just an interesting coincidence. She was in 87 episodes of Renegade with her then-husband, Lorenzo Lamas. Side note, they divorced halfway through that show. Yeah, just continuing a working relationship, good on them, because that can't be easy. Kathleen was in That Thing You Do with Tom Hanks, who may or may not be a pedophile. he was in Apollo 13 with Kevin Bacon, who was in Wild Things with Bill Murray, who was in Ghostbusters. You just got busted again. And those roles aside, horror fans will remember her as the vixen, Kelly Meeker, who steals Brady away from Rachel in Halloween 4. You hussy. Cops do it by the book. Before we talk about Kathleen, I have to go back to Kelly Meeker. What a fucking letdown that you have a woman in the sex scene of a movie with boobs that are that enormous, and you tease showing them, but you don't. Halloween 4 is the blue balls entry of the franchise. I will stand by that to the day I die. All right, let's talk about her importance to the role. Gloria's character is, she has a fatal disease, and they don't really go too deep into what it is, but I mean, she's dying. And there's actually some nice allusions in the dialogue to things that are going to happen later. Dan comes in to check on her, and he's like asking her, saying that like she put on makeup, and then she tell her that she looks nice, and she says something along the lines of, well, my head is the only thing that isn't sick, something along that lines. And then later on, her head is what is used to create the bride of Reanimator. So I thought that was a nice little foreshadowing of events. Good writing on that part. Her importance to the role is that she's the stand-in for Meg in the physical form. And I love that Dan Cain there's this split allegiance between his dick and his heart. He's a good doctor, and he cares about his patients, and he wants her not to die, but it's an inevitability. So when the opportunity to create the bride Reanimator, she's not even in his mind. He just doesn't want her to go. But Dr. West, Jeffrey Combs, he has that amazing way to convince Dan Cain to do anything. So he looks at her face, and he's attracted to her, but it's Meg's heart that he loves, and that's going to definitely come into play later on. He's like, what do you want? When he rejects her and she rips her own heart out. Amazing, amazing stuff. I feel like on an acting end, even though she doesn't have a lot to do in this movie, she's utilized way better than Fabiana. Every little thing she does ends up being, the ramifications are very big. I think that without Kathleen Kinmont, this movie would kind of fall flat, because you could put another pretty actress in this role, and I just don't know that it would read as sympathetically as it does, because it's all in her eyes when she's laying there on the bed. She's so frail and has very little life, but there's such a connection just in the way that her eyes are telling you that she's scared. I mean, she does audibly say she's scared, but it's conveyed more in her eyes than anything else. Dan Cain, being that she is the Meg character, or the Meg avatar, he has a need to keep her alive because he feels guilty for letting Meg die. And I wish that was highlighted a little more. I think they needed more scenes together, Dan and Gloria, before our big finale. And the middle section of this movie is a little thin, so I think they could have done more of that stuff. But at the same time, it probably would have separated from the scenes that we get with Dan and Jeffrey. Or Dan and Herbert. When I said earlier that this movie needed a couple of rewrites, that may be an understatement. I think that you could take the character of Francesca and the character of Gloria, and you could put them together. Now, I love Fabiana Eugenio. She's beautiful, and in that regard, she's a better fit. But I think Kathleen Kinmont should have been the whole of this story. So you could have had her as being a doctor in Peru, which the beginning of the film takes place during a civil war. Maybe she's injured in it. And then you have Dan Cain trying to keep her alive. Or maybe none of that happens and she shows back up and then she's inadvertently injured during the whole events of the film. Well, wherever you have her get hurt, you know, you build that love story, you take her out, she dies tragically, and then you have the need of Dan to reanimate her because he feels guilty. He's lost another love of his life. I think they just could have streamlined the story a little more, but I get why they did it the way they did it, because they wanted a love triangle. And there is some great stuff towards the end of the film between Fabiana and Kathleen, where as all the red flags are there for Fabiana to want nothing to do with Bruce Abbott's character, but you know, I guess he slung her some good dick, and then she can't quit him. She kind of gets near him, and then Kathleen Kinmont as the bride is like, shh. Get the fuck away from my man. It's satisfying, but this movie has a strong beginning and a strong ending, and then the middle part needed some work. So yeah, as fun as the love triangle stuff is, I think you could have consolidated these two characters into one and got a more streamlined narrative. And then you could have had more fun with your principal characters, you know, doing experiments and saying funny things back and forth. But that's just my... Now, one role that could have almost entirely been eliminated is the role of Dr. Graves, played by the longtime character actor Mel Stewart. You've probably seen him in... He was in Car 54, Where Are You? He was in a recurring character. Best known as Henry Jefferson in All in the Family, which got spun off into the Jeffersons. And he was Billy in 89 episodes of Scarecrow and Mrs. King, which does not include a female wife of a king or a scarecrow. Fuck that show. Fuck that show. Fuck you, CBS. I was very disappointed as a kid because you hear Scarecrow and Mrs. King, and you're like, fuck, this is going to be awesome. It is not. So basically, his entire character... could have been eliminated from the movie if not for the fact that he has arms. Because basically his entire necessity going forward is to act as Dr. Hill's hands. Now he does give some expository dialogue between him and Lieutenant Chapman about things that happened in the first movie, which I think is a necessity in case you have somebody who's jumped aboard the sequel but didn't see the original. But a lot of that stuff was done in the prologue as well. You're fleshing out details, and in film you're supposed to show, not say. So I feel like that they did not a great job in utilizing this actor, and he's fine. He's a fine actor, and he has some good reactions. He has a fight with a bat that he has reanimated. And it's almost reminiscent of the first movie where you have Combs who reanimated the cat, and it's a puppet, and he's, you know, fighting with it. But his entire purpose is to just tell you things that you need to know and literally be someone's hands. Our final new addition to the cast, in many ways, becomes the film's real antagonist, and that's Claude Earl Jones as Leslie Chapman. Now, he was the coach in 1981's Evil Speak, and he played Philby in Dark Knight of the Scarecrow, which I, hands down, is the greatest made-for-television horror movie ever made. And he also had some smaller roles in Dallas, Quantum Leap, Baywatch, and Matlock. Even though the investigation of the Miskatonic Massacre from 8 months before has, he's got a vested interest in what happened. Now, we'll get a curveball with that a little later on, but initially you think his motivations are pure because, well, his wife, who had died, had been reanimated, and she is now in the mental ward of Miskatonic Hospital. When Francesca shows up, and they have what they call a meet cute between her and Dan, and they make arrangements to have dinner that night. Chapman is just kind of hanging out at the hospital looking for, you know, things out of the blue to pounce upon, you know, that sleuth kind of motivation. And he sees Francesca and he's like, "Hey, well, come with me. I'm a police officer." And he takes her to the mental ward, and you've got the surviving corpses of the first film, even though they're not actually in the first movie, but you have more reanimated bodies. And they're, you know, bouncing around in the padded cell. And for whatever reason, this cop can just go wherever he wants. And these are obviously dangerous patients. But I guess because maybe one of them is his wife, they're cool with it. And standards in the early 90s weren't what they are now. But they walk in there. And of course, his reanimated wife tries to attack Francesca to no avail. But the thing that kind of turns this all around, because at first you feel like, okay, this guy has a personal stake and he wants justice for his wife that he loves so dearly. But then you find out that his wife died from spousal abuse, and that revelation completely recontextualizes the entire movie. So they're like, why is he doing this? They just needed him to do it. But I think the reason that they had this revelation is because even though what Dan Cain and Herbert West are doing is wrong, they're still the quote-unquote heroes of our film. So I thought that was kind of cheap that they had to paint this guy they had to give him motivation to be around, but then they had to kind of, well, but here's X, Y, and Z of why he's not the hero of the film. Now, this guy's great in the role. He's not as good as, the foils in the first film, but that's a completely different subject. The things that make him just so, even if they didn't have this revelation, you just don't like him. He's so fucking sleazy. It's just the way he says his name. Chapman. I don't like him. I don't like him at all. And so I guess in broad strokes, they did a good job of, you know, creating an antagonist you wanted to see get disposed. And we'll talk about his demise in a few. Whether Chapman's actions make Dr. West or Dan Cain look like saints in comparison is kind of besides the point. Sooner or later, Chapman's actions are going to come back to bite him in the ass. So let's not waste any time. We're here what we came for. Let's talk about the blood and guts of Bride of Reanimator. Now, our first victim is either a Peruvian citizen caught in the crossfire of a civil war, or he's a soldier very badly wounded in battle. Dr. West and Dr. Cain perform emergency surgery to save the man's life, but with no avail. They try to remove this like huge chunk of shrapnel from his chest, and he bleeds out. I gave it a 4 out of 10. The gushing blood looks great, but in terms of creativity, kind of low on the totem pole. Our second victim is actually our first, only this time Dr. West sees an opportunity to experiment on a fresh subject. He injects him with reagent, and this would be reagent version 2.0, which includes embryonic fluid from a species of iguana because it has regenerative properties. However, when the reanimated subject reacts in a violent manner, Dr. West puts a bullet between his eyes. Now, I'm all for someone shooting somebody in the head, but there is no blowback of the skull, and there's no muzzle flash from the gun. It's just a sound effect. So 1 out of 10. I felt like that was comparative to this movie. Like, why that just didn't work, and they could have done so much more with that. Our third victim charges the medical tent occupied by Dr. West and Dr. Kane. When he rushes the doctors, he meets his bitter end at the end of a razor-sharp machete wielded by Dr. Kane. He plants the machete in the back of his neck just deep enough to, well, just not deep enough to decapitate him, which would have put it over the edge for me. 4 out of 10. The impact is good, but I feel that a decapitation coming, I felt it was coming on, and I was let down that it didn't happen. Now, our fourth and fifth victims infiltrate the medical tent, only to be quickly dispensed with gunshots courtesy of Dr. West. Now, I ranked this one a little higher, 3 out of 10, because the gunshots are more believable, but yet again, still not very creative in the grand scheme of things. Now, here's a note. These first five victims, these all take place before the opening credits of the movie. So this movie has kind of, you know, has started with a gunshot. Like, literally, you hit the ground running. Victim number six, Dr. West kills Lieutenant Chapman by inducing a heart attack with a rag soaked in chemicals. This is something they introduce a little earlier in the film as a means of killing somebody without a trace. West does it on an iguana, and he extracts the its sac that has the embryonic fluid in it. So that whole thing sets the wheels in motion for you to understand how this new reagent works, and then you get to see the rag actually utilized. I guess it would be Chekhov's rag in this situation, as opposed to Chekhov's gun. I gave it a 3 out of 10. It's by no means a great kill, but it is a means to an end. It does set up later for where he gets killed in reanimated form, which we'll talk about in a bit. The seventh death of the film will hit you right in the feels, because you have Gloria succumbing to her illness as Dr. Kane holds her hand. I gave this a 6 out of 10. There's nothing creative about this scene, but the reaction and the acting between Kathleen and Bruce, you get to see them really chomp the scenery, and for that reason alone, the death actually means something, therefore it should be held in a higher regard. So like I said, 6 out of 10. Our eighth and ninth victims are two nurses who are killed off screen. They escaped, they were killed by the, presumably at least, by the escaped reanimated patients in the mental ward of the hospital. And they've been telepathically summoned by Dr. Hill, which is one of the callbacks to the original film. 3 out of 10. The makeup is decent. There's the blood, just the setting of the scene kind of sells you on the moment. But I had to deduct points because it's off screen. Come on. You don't watch these movies to hear about somebody getting killed. You want to see it happen. All right. Number 10 on our list of victims is the titular bride herself, who through a painful process of tissue rejection sees her body literally fall apart. Hands fall, arms sink, torso rips in two, and you've got that great methicellulose goo in between, and it just drips. And then her neck stretches away from her body, and her slowly and painfully the head falls backwards, where the entirety of the spine follows. 10 out of 10. Visually stunning, and it's perfectly lit to show off how amazing the special effects work. Of the crew, one of the most spectacular things you'll ever see in a 1990s horror movie, definitely. But we're in that great butter zone of like the late 80s, early 90s, where everything's still practical. You gotta love it. Now, I'm guessing there is a subsect to the listening audience who is thinking to themselves that those kills are okay, but in comparison to the original, they're not as memorable. I might be inclined to agree with you, but the area where Bride Reanimator really maybe it's beat its predecessor is in the creature effects department. We're going to go down the line and discuss the amazing creature work, but first we got to talk about the men who comprised this crew. Society also has an amazing cast of characters, and this was a lot more prevalent back then, where you just had all these guys who were going to become legends working together. But having all these, every one of these guys on the same movie is just breathtaking when you look at their list of accomplishments. Greg Nicotero, Howard Berger, Robert Kurtzman, John Carl Beekler, Nick Benson, and Screaming Mad George. Okay, obviously Nicotero, Berger, and Kurtzman, that's K and B. The dominant force in special effects in the post digital era. I mean, they're still keeping things going. I mean, like, all the way, let's talk about Nicotero. I mean, Walking Dead, the only positive thing I can say about the show is his effects. Past that first season, it's not really my cup of tea, but Berger and Kurtzman, they're not slouches either. John Carl Beekler, who is probably the most talked about special effects artist in the history of this podcast, just because everything we talk about has some connection to him. We just lost him not long ago, but he, omnipresent, absolutely omnipresent. And he made the head, the bat prop of Carl Hill, who the animatronic of it, you know, working. And that's just, how do you not love that? Nick Benson, who did preliminary work with Screaming Mad George, shout out to Nick Benson, worked on Nightmare on Street 4, Night of the Demons, very, very talented guy. And Screaming Mad George, who worked on Society and several other great films of the era. When you take into consideration all these guys and their individual legacies and the fact that they all worked on the exact same movie at the same time, that can't be understated. That's an amazing, amazing achievement in special effects. You know, and so let's break them down. The Wizards of Gore, they're all well known in their field, despite the fact that some of them may have separately be known for other films. But collectively, Bride of Reanimator may be in a class of it on its own. So number one, Dr. West constructs an abomination made entirely from discarded fingers and an eyeball. It springs to life. It strolls around the living room while the doctors are being interrogated by Lieutenant Chapman. The finger, the eyeball, albeit gross as fuck, it's seemingly docile. And it's actually gross and still kind of a cute way, which just makes his death all the more funny because he gets accidentally squished by a book by Lieutenant Chapman. And there's a whole cat and mouse element of that scene of Dan Cain and Herbert West seeing the effect going on, and the little eyeball finger guy, but Chapman doesn't see it. And then Chapman picks up this book and just slams it on him, and that's the end of that whole thing. It's very reminiscent of Evil Dead 2, and in my book, that is never a bad thing. 9 out of 10. Very creative and puppeted effectively and realistically. Number 2 effect. Dr. Graves, in an effort to identify the reagent left after the Miskatonic Massacre, successfully reanimates a bat. 3 out of 10. It's funny, but it's not super convincing. The fight he has with the bat, however, is absolute gold, and that's one of the hallmarks of a reanimator film. You have to have somebody fighting with a puppet or a stuffed animal of some kind. Number 3, the successful reanimation of the bat by Dr. Graves leads him to revive the decapitated head of Dr. Hill, only to be recently discovered by Lieutenant Chapman from a sideshow carnival just outside of Arkham. Nevertheless, Dr. Hill's head is resurrected and is out for revenge. 9 out of 10. Incredibly simple, old-school magic tricks, but it looks effective, and it's even better in this movie than in the original. It's literally just a guy with his head through a table, and there's a prosthetic flap, you know, to hide the seam, or the seam being, you know, where the table stops and the head starts. 9 out of 10. Great, great stuff. Number 4, an effect that is very reminiscent of Evil Dead 2, another one, sees Dr. West take a steel rod and stab one end into a detached foot and the other into a severed arm, and they're both reanimated. 7 out of 10. There's no mystery as to how they achieve this effect, but it does the trick. Also, as good as the effect is, you have to give some credit to Jeffrey Combs for his acting with the props, because his reaction to being strangled and kicked in the face is absolutely priceless. Number five. Shortly after Lieutenant Chapman is reanimated, a crazed brawl ensues in the basement, Dr. West and Dan Kane's home. It's like this old mausoleum out by the cemetery. However, Dr. West fights back with a machete and manages to chop off the right arm of Lieutenant Chapman. And to beat all, Chapman manages to cauterize this wound with an open flame in one fell swoop. I'll give this a 5 out of 10. Interesting, but comparatively to some of the other things in the movie, there's definitely better things to come. Number six, the reanimated Lieutenant Chapman seizes Francesca's dog and just ragdolls the fuck out of it. Like I said, Hallmark, you have to have somebody fighting with a stuffed animal. Needless to say, it's dead. Dr. West just can't help himself and he reanimates the dog and needlessly adds a human arm to it, which I think is a really funny visual gag, you know, because a trained dog, like, I shake hands and it'll bring its paw up. And he's standing in a doorway and Francesca comes down and the dog extends its human hand. And she just freaks the fuck out, which is half of her entire character in the film, is just to freak the fuck out. 6 out of 10, incredibly goofy. But in a movie like this, it's so damn enjoyable. Number seven, the fruit of Dan Kane and Herbert West's labor, the bride of Reanimator, crafted from the feet of a ballet dancer, the legs of a street prostitute, the womb of a virgin, the arms of a waitress, the hand of a lawyer, and the other hand is of an artist, the heart of Meg Halsey, and the head of Gloria. 10 out of 10. There's no way to properly articulate how impressive a makeup job it is. It just simply has to be seen. I want to say it took them like 10 hours to put this on her, and they got it down to, I think, maybe like 6. But cast her entire body. This is not a makeup job that you can take lightly. I mean, this is an entire body prosthesis. And the other thing that's interesting about it is the medical gauze around her to both serves as a means to kind of hide the seams in places, but it also works as a bridal gown. And I know that was obviously intentional, but it's not intentional in the sense that it wouldn't look that way naturally. So I thought that was a nice visual cue that she is the bride of Reanimator, you know, in literal and figurative terms. Amazing. KMB did all that, so hats off to them. Number eight, we have the evolution of the severed head of Dr. Hill, now having bat wings grafted to it, giving him the ability of flight. Now, aside from the fact that it's just fun visually, my favorite aspect of it comes from how Dr. West discovers it. So he answers the door, and there's just a box sitting on the doorstep, and he opens it up, and a severed head with bat wings is in it. 9 out of 10, corny as fuck, but I absolutely love it. It's a great use of old school, you know, rear projection, or it may be composite. I'm not exactly sure how they achieved it, but it definitely looks a little hokey. You see the black, you know, matte lines around the props sometimes, but then come on. I mean, it is of its time, but it just in context, it's so enjoyable. You can't help but love it. Number nine, another one of Dr. West's mad experiments comes back to cause problems for him when the monstrosity of a reanimated head that has a foot and an arm grafted to it shows up in the mausoleum at the command of Dr. Hill. 8 out of 10, it's odd, but it looks great. This is something that you would see in a Frank Henenlotter movie. Harkening back to Frankenhooker, same year. Very, very similar. Number 10, the torso of a reanimated man and a woman are stitched together, kind of like the human version of Cat Dog. This is a great effect. I'm not exactly sure how they achieved it. 10 out of 10. By 2020 standards, it still gets my seal of approval. And last but certainly not least, one of the final abnormal pairings of a male and a female body vertically have been put together back to back. This is a 7 out of 10. I would have ranked this higher if not for the fact that the prop is static on one side and has motion on the other. Now, Screaming Mad George made this prop. And the cool thing about it is it's almost the exact same prop or the idea of a prop that he used in Society. Because there's this part where a body comes out of bed and turns around and it's, you know, face on both sides. This is a little more gruesome, but I think I actually prefer the effect in Society because the fact that when in this movie you get the non-moving side first, and then it turns around, then you get the actor portrayal. I don't know. Your eye has enough time to adjust and see that it's an effect. But it's still a really great effect. I don't want to sell it short. But in the grand scheme of things, comparatively, it could have been a little better. Gotta be honest with you guys, there's not really much more to go into with Bride Reanimator. However, we did get quite a few fan questions this month, so let's break it down in our mailbag. This first question comes from Matt Underwood. If the Reanimator series were to ever be remade, who would you cast as Herbert West? If the subject matter is taken more seriously, like a serious tone, then I think Matthew Gray Gubler from Criminal Minds, he plays a character called Spencer Reed. I think he would be really good in the role. You could get him to do like the techno babble, and I just think that aesthetically you could kind of make him look like Herbert West. However, if the series were rebooted in a more tongue-in-cheek tone, my definitely hanging its hat on the comedic side, then my hands down, it's got to be John Hamm. I think he would absolutely kill it as Herbert West. Yeah, pun intended, by the way. He's a solid actor all around, but I think he's proven in the past few years that he's a natural at comedy. Bridesmaids, he's really funny in that. Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, he has a recurring role as a kind of a cult leader who kept these women down in a bunker. But he's really funny, so I think that he could add a lot in that regard, and I could just see him with the glasses. The problem with this, and to who you would ask, it may be a minor or a major problem, is that dude's like handsome as fuck. Like, you know, Don Draper, you know, I mean, that dude's not known for being an uggo. The character of Dan Cain ideally should be the more attractive of the two. He's the ladies' man. He's the one, you know, betting all the ladies. But I don't know, you can maybe have fun with that all the women want to get with Herbert West, even though he's like a super creep. I don't know. There's some fun to be had there. But that's be my answer. Either Matthew Gray Gubler or, if you want to go in a more comedic route, John Hamm. This question comes from Mike Wilson. I'm a big fan of Brian Usna's work as a director, and I feel like he's constantly overshadowed by the other horror directors of the 80s and 90s. Why do you think that is? Well, I kind of think you answered your own question. Unfortunately, the 80s and 90s were just so jam-packed with genre-specific filmmakers that Brian's work is just lost in the mix. The films he directed are, or can be, a little more on the extreme side. I think he's kind of unintentionally boxed out a portion of horror audiences who don't care for like body horror and like extreme gore. The other aspect being he was primarily a producer, which I think he is held in a more high regard in that end. That's not to say that I think he's a bad director. I think he's a great director. I'll say this, I think he's very underrated as a director, and the genre would be worse off without him. You're never going to proselytize the general audience on, you know, B-movie cinema too much. This question comes from Adam Parton. I've never liked Bride Reanimator because it's just too goofy. I prefer the first film where the comedy came exclusively from the performances rather than the poorly written dialogue. Do you think this movie would be better if it was closer to the original? Now, I'm assuming by when you mean closer to the original, you mean tonally. The first movie does play a little more straightforward than the sequel, but I think to call Bride goofy and insinuate that part one isn't is being a little ridiculous. We're talking about a movie where a man has a fight with a stuffed cat. So come on. I think Bride could probably have used several rewrites on the script just to tighten the narrative, but the comedy works for me. But I admittedly may be in the minority on that. But I don't think that Bride suffers from its comedy. It just suffers from a weaker script in general. Okay, this our final question comes from Titty Flippin' Travis, and you know it's gonna be bizarre. Do you think the bride would have been happier with a removable dick and a pussy so she could pleasure herself instead of seeking pleasure from someone that doesn't love her back? Could have saved a life. Well, the issue that the bride ultimately succumbs to is the tissue, you know, rejection. So I would have to think that, I mean, if she's plugging new body parts, you know, with other body parts, that may just have sped up the process. I don't know. I'm not my place to judge. Oh man, you can always count on Titty Flip and Travis to ask something so ridiculous you can't help but just laugh. With that being said, I hope these retrospectives are bringing you all out there in the Rant Army some enjoyment, or at the very least, a nice chuckle. Considering all the horrible shit going on in the world, Lord knows we could all use a good laugh right now. So if you'd like to laugh and learn a little more, please follow us on social media at Rants Black Lodge. Subscribe to the podcast, that being the Rants from the Black Lodge podcast, on one of the many platforms we're available on, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, Player FM, iHeartRadio, Pandora, and on down the list. Don't forget to stop by our homepage at JuicyKruger.com. And for the love of Cthulhu, please consider buying a t-shirt or a mug from our web store at RantArmy.com. That's going to close us out for this month, but stay tuned. Next month is October, so you know we got something extra special in store. Till then, Rant Army, keep marching.